Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to episode 32 of Speaking of Mysteries. This week's guest is Scottish crime fiction writer Val McDermott. A few weeks ago, in the introduction to my interview with Craig Robertson, I went on at great length about how much I enjoy crime fiction by Scottish writers. Don't get me wrong, I like crime fiction, thrillers, and suspense novels from writers from all over, but there's just something about Scottish crime fiction. In that introduction, I quoted Val from a past interview in which she explained the differentiation between Scottish and English mystery writing. So in addition to asking her about her latest standalone, The Skeleton Road, I'm delighted to say that she expands on what sets Scottish crime fiction apart. We also talked about her past standalones, her three series, and maybe the beginning of a fourth, about the Scottish referendum for independence, and soccer. Here is Val McDermott. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. I'm delighted beyond belief to greet our guest this week, Val McDermott. So thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You had an incredibly productive year, in addition to The Skeleton Road, which we'll talk about.
Some might say productive. I would say stupid, but there you go.
You released the nonfiction forensic, The Anatomy of Crime, Northanger Abbey, the second book in the Austin Project, and in 2013, Cross and Burn, the eighth book in the Tony Hill Carol Jordan series. You program crime writing festivals and read manuscripts of new writers. I read that you scoff at the suggestion that you work too hard, but maybe you do?
Well, I think I had 18 months of working stupidly hard. And it was mostly because people offered me projects that were time-sensitive that I just couldn't resist. For me, one of the great things about being a writer is the challenge involved, the prospect of each book being, if not better every time, then at least different from anything I've done before. And to be offered the chance to do something quite so different doesn't come along that often. And both the Austin project and the non-fiction project, I just couldn't resist them. And so I said yes, in spite of everyone around me going, are you mad? And so I ended up having a period of about 18 months where I kind of got up every day and wrote. And when I finished one book, it was like, okay, go and make a cup of coffee and then start the next one.
Well, I think you may have had 18 months of madness, but the rest of us will have weeks of delight. So thank you. The story of Skeleton Road begins in Edinburgh with the discovery of the skeleton of the title. But the bulk of the story takes place in the Balkans and Oxford. The locations of the vanishing point shifted from Scotland to the US to Romania. And in A Darker Domain, published in 2008, the action shifts between Scotland and Tuscany. Is that part of the globalization of crime fiction writing, or are you just restless for vistas that contrast with Scotland?
I think it always comes down to story with me. I get an idea for a story and I think, well, how do I make this story work? And sometimes the how is tied up with the where. I think quite a few of my books use place with a very specific role. It's almost as if the story couldn't happen anywhere else. You know, in the place of execution, it seemed to me that the story was organic. It came out of the Derbyshire Peak District. It was for me, in my imagination, it was unique to that place. A Darker Domain, the same. It was unique to the place where it started off and indeed to the Italian place that it ended up. And I suppose it's partly because those are places that I know, and so I find them suitable locations for telling stories against. But I do have a desire to make the story work almost visually in my head while I'm writing it, and so that means a place that I have a strong sense of, and I hope that when I write it, that conveys itself to the reader. And I know as a reader that the books that the writers that stay with me the longest are the ones who have that distinctive sense of place. You know, I'm thinking of Sarah Paretsky's Chicago, Michael Connelly writing about Los Angeles, Laura Lippman writing about Baltimore. They make those places come alive in a way that makes the story more vivid, I suppose.
Well, I remember in The Vanishing Point, Romania, you made Romania, it was Romania, please.
Yeah.
seem incredibly creepy.
Yeah.
And that came through, like, wow, this place sounds really, really spooky, like very Transylvanian.
Well, there are quite a few places in Central Europe that have that same sort of feeling. But I think one of the great advantages of what I do for a living is that I often get invited to festivals in places that I've never been before, and places that you wouldn't necessarily think of going on holiday, but places that are actually very interesting and often very beautiful, but a bit off the beaten track, you know, for in terms of tourism. So you do get the opportunity to come up with places that might be useful for fiction that aren't necessarily going to be entirely familiar to your readers.
I think a lot of your novels, especially your standalones, are love stories. Love in all its permutations, including love lost and love thwarted, wrapped up in mysteries. In The Skeleton Road, all the characters grapple with the choices love has presented. Is this part of the plan from the beginning in your books?
I don't really think about things in those terms when I'm writing, either in terms of the moral dilemmas or the sort of ethical purpose of the story. Again, as I said, it comes down to story. A story presents itself to me, or a story develops in my head over a period of time, often a period of years, and it's always the narrative pool that engages with me. I don't think in terms of themes or how relationships are going to work out in a bigger scheme. Is this a love story? Is it a murder story? Is this what is this? I don't analyse them in that way before I start. And often it's only quite a long time after I finish a book that I understand what it was about, almost. I remember about 18 months after I'd published The Mermaid Singing, doing an event, and one of the audience put his hand up and said, "It seems to me that this is a book about gender. It's about what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman." And I thought about it on my feet, as it were, and I thought, you're absolutely right, but it wasn't what I was thinking when I wrote it. I was just thinking about the next step in the story. So I suppose there's a lot of stuff sort of going on in the back of my head that I'm not conscious of when I'm writing. And I think that's probably for the good in terms of the reader engaging with the book. I sometimes think if you start off with, this is going to be my big homelessness book, you end up becoming, standing on a soapbox preaching to the reader rather than drawing them in through the means of the story and the characters to maybe a wider picture.
Well, talking about characters, you've created three crime fiction series, Tony Hill and Carol Jordan, Kate Brannigan, and Lindsay Gordon. You're still adding to the Tony Hill and Carol Jordan series. In The Skeleton Road, though, which is described as a standalone, has Karen Pyrie. But this isn't the first time we've met her. She's now Detective Chief Inspector Pyrie. She was also featured in A Darker Domain and The Distant Echo. At what point do books that feature characters we've read before become series?
Well, that's a very good question, Nancy, and it's what I've been asking myself, really. And I think that there will be more books that feature Karen Pyrie. I'm slightly reluctant to call them a series because it seems to me that Karen occupies a slightly different role in the books to my other protagonists. I mean, it's very much the case that the Lindsay Gordon books, the Kate Brannigan books, the Tilly Hill and Carol Jordan books, those characters are front and centre. The whole book kind of revolves around them. But it seems to me that with the books that have featured Karen, although she does play a key role in the book, she's not the only person that the book is about. And it's almost as if she's the glue that holds the book together, rather than being front and centre who the book is all about. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense to you. So I don't know if I'm quite in my head ready to call it a series yet, or something, a recurring character. but I think it's clear to me that there will be at least one more book featuring Karen, because and that's probably a marker of this as a series now, because pretty much as soon as I had finished The Skeleton Road, I had an idea in my head for another book featuring Karen and her department, and that's kind of developing in the back of my head at the moment, so that'll probably be what I write after the book I'm writing now.
Well, cold cases, I think, make particularly good mysteries, especially mysteries that can look back in time and move in place.
Uh-huh.
And she has great co-workers, like the forensic pathologist. Is that what she is, River? And
she's a forensic anthropologist, but yeah, she does. She's a trained pathologist as well.
And she's, it's a great dynamic between the two of them, mm-hmm. how they work together.
Yeah.
So it would be great to see them again.
Yeah, and I mean, actually, River started off in another standalone. She started off in The Grave Tattoo. So I kind of think that my standalone novels occupy a fictitious universe of their own, and people can move between books without it necessarily being the commitment of a series.
Well, that's the beauty. You have complete control over the characters. Well, maybe not complete control, but you can at least make them show up in a book. Maybe you can't make them behave.
Yeah, I used to have a partner who always wanted to share my dessert, you know, and I would always like be sort of like grabbing my spoon from me, and I'd say, why don't you just ask for two spoons? And she would say, oh, spoon's too much of a commitment. And in the same way, I almost feel like it's too much of a commitment to say the Karen Perry series.
I want to ask you a question about dividing fiction into different categories. Literary fiction, mystery, paranormal, all that. And you haven't made a secret that you have a distaste for this. And, you know, a good story is a good story. I've asked a lot of writers why they think this is. Nick Harkaway suggested it was a function of shelf organization, and others felt it was a disdain that lumps all mystery and suspense back to the dime novel days. But why do you think this differentiation between literary fiction and so-called genre fiction exists?
Well, I think there is some truth in saying that, you know, harking back to the early days of genre fiction, it didn't stand comparison with most genre fiction didn't stand in comparison with most so-called literary fiction. It was written with a different purpose in mind. But the world has shifted a lot in the last 30 years. And I think that writers who are now writing what we classify as genre fiction are often some of the most accomplished storytellers and prose stylists around. It's no longer the preserve of the literary novel, which, of course, is also the domain of academe. You know, this is the world that the academics like to treat as their own, as something somehow rarefied that only they can enjoy, only people who have had a level of cultural education to a certain point are able to appreciate. So there's a certain amount, I think, of intellectual snobbery. It's about building walls, I think. Now, I'm all for knocking walls down and drawing people in. I want the world of story, the world of books, to be inclusive, not exclusive, not to make people feel daunted by being told something's a literary novel and they shouldn't really be reading it because it's a bit beyond them. I think that, you know, good story is good story and good writing is good writing wherever you find it. And for, you know, these historic reasons no longer pertain at all in today's field. It always seemed interesting to me that if you start off as a genre writer, you're always labelled forever. You're labelled forever as a genre writer. But if you start off as a so-called literary writer, you can be like Margaret Atwood and write work that is definitely within the genre field, but you remain a literary writer who's dabbling, as it were, in genre. So it's all entirely, it seems to me, entirely arbitrary and often very silly. But it does allow people to, I suppose, keep the walls up, to keep the common people out. And of course, historically, one of the reasons why so many women have ended up as genre writers, whether that's crime or historical fiction or romance, is that in the 1920s and 1930s, when the crime, the golden age of crime fiction really started happening, the world of literary fiction was a very male domain. And you know, very deliberately so, women were basically excluded and told to go away and do their knitting, sort of thing. You know, it's like, we've got Virginia Woolf, we've got Elizabeth Bowen, we don't need anybody.
We have a woman,
exactly that. And so the historical roots, if you like, of women's presence in the genre go back there to that kind of gender snobbery, that kind of almost misogyny in terms of the world of letters. So we did carve out a very different space for ourselves in genre fiction. So there are all these complicated reasons why those prejudices have taken so long to uproot. But I think, I really do think that in the last few years we have seen a big shift in people's consciousness about this, and people are a lot less sniffy, if you like, particularly about the crime genre, because there is so much interesting work being done here.
Absolutely. When I interviewed you last time, we had probably the best interview I've ever had when you talk specifically about Scotland. So I'm going to ask a question. I'm actually going to ask two. Scotland has a population that's just shy of 5.5 million people, but there's an embarrassment of riches when it comes to the number of Scottish crime fiction writers working today. Is there a cultural predisposition, not just to crime writing, but to really, really good crime writing? Is there something in the water?
Well, I think one of the things is we have no tradition of crime fiction in this country. We don't have, if you like, the millstone of Dorothy Sayers and Agatha Christie and Niall Marsh and Marjorie Allingham round our necks. That's not our literary tradition. Insofar as we've got a crime fiction tradition, it comes down through James Hogg's Confessions of a Justified Sinner, through Robert Louis Stevenson, Jekyll and Hyde, through Conan Doyle. And the first real sort of monument in the landscape of modern crime fiction is William McIlvany's novel Laidlaw, which was published in the late 1970s. Now, Scotland has, ever since the 18th century, 17th, 18th century, had a great flowering of intellect, of it's called the Enlightenment, it was called the Edinburgh Enlightenment, which was about philosophy and about poetry and about Walter Scott writing fiction. And there are some who say that because of the union of the crowns and the union of the parliament, the minds that would have been employed governing Scotland were employed in thinking and pursuing the life of the mind rather than the body politic. But in modern terms, I would say, there's been a great flowering of Scottish literature since the 1970s. And I think that's partly because that's when we started to have the political debate about our future as a country. Did we want to be independent? Did we want a devolved parliament? And when you start thinking in those terms, you have to start looking at yourself and saying, well, who are we? What kind of country do we want to be? What are our aspirations? What's our history? What's our tradition? What do we want our future to be? And that, I think, does provoke an uprising, if you like, in writing fiction, because the novel and the play, they're places where you can explore those questions, but you're exploring it not in a didactic or a polemic way. You're exploring it in a way that people can engage with and go away thinking about. And I think that it's no coincidence that we started producing this great panoply of excellent contemporary crime fiction at a time when we were thinking about who we are, thinking about the society we occupy, what kind of world we wanted it to be, what kind of society we wanted it to be, because the crime novel really lends itself to exploring social histories, to exploring the society we live in. And I think that's because the nature of murder, if you like, it's not a small hermetically sealed world that the book draws on. The crime novel has its tentacles that stretch right across the social spectrum from the highest to the lowest. you know, the victim, their family, their friends, their workmates, their colleagues, their neighbours. You've got the witnesses, you've got the suspects, you've got the police officers, you've got the forensic scientists, you've got the media who are drawn in to cover the case. There's all sorts of people who get sucked in to a murder, and that allows you to explore lots of different social groupings and lots of different political possibilities, but just to write about the world that you're in a way that you can do very few other places.
You know, Scotland obviously was very much in the news recently, at least out here in California. Unfortunately, it usually involved Mel Gibson with his face painted blue, but...
God.
Yes, if you know, the scene from Braveheart.
Yes.
So, but my question about is you and your countrymen and women, you know, you gave the English quite a scare, and the other of your fellow crime writers, Scottish crime writers that I've spoken to, most of them felt that they hadn't heard the last of the idea of Scotland as a separate country. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think there'll be another referendum within 5 to 10 years. And I suspect that this time will go.
You really truly think that within five to ten years there'll be another referendum?
Yes. I mean, I think... We came a lot closer than most people thought that we could.
Your largest city was in favor. Glasgow was in favor.
Yeah.
And I think that that's always telling, because that's that's where the critical mass of population is.
Yeah, and interestingly, there are a couple of interesting things about the demographic. One of the things that I found very interesting was that the demographic group that had the most support for the yes vote was Scottish Asians. So, I mean, that to me is a way of sort of saying, you know, as Asians, as immigrants in this country, we feel a lot more comfortable than our cousins and our brothers in the rest of the UK. We like it here. You know, you make us welcome. But the other interesting thing, I think, was that if you took the over 65s out of the equation, then the figures would have been reversed. It would have been 55 for independence and 45 against. And as my son said when he looked at that picture, he said, "Do the maths, mummy."
So let's switch gears a little bit. In addition to being a crime fiction and nonfiction writer, you've become one of the Wraith Rover sponsors.
Yeah.
Do you plan to continue your sponsorship? And are you planning
a
crime fiction novel in the world of football?
Well, I don't know about that. I'm certainly signed up to sponsor the home shirts for another season. I think it's problematic, and people have tried to write crime novels, not just set against the world of football, but against the world of sports in general. And I think that they've not been entirely successful. You know, I mean, before Harlan Coben became the sort of international best-selling phenomenon that he has become, you know, he wrote all those very entertaining Myron Bolitar novels about sport, and they never quite took off for him in the way that his standalone novels have since. And you know, people have attempted to write novels set in the world of soccer, and they've just somehow not worked. And I'm not quite sure why that is, because it seems to me that crime fiction readers in general are very open to the idea of reading about worlds that are not their own world, but perhaps there's a sort of resistance to the world of sport somehow. I don't know. I mean, I touched on football in Beneath the Bleeding. It comes into play, as it were, but the book isn't about football. It's not set in that world. Mind you, some of the stories you would hear as a director of a football club, you know, you wouldn't believe if you put them in a book. People would go, "That couldn't happen."
Well,
really and truly, some of the stuff is quite make your hair stand on end.
But I'm also thinking about American football, where we have a well-defined and indicted and incarcerated criminal element of all sorts of really dreadful crimes against women, children, and animals.
Yeah,
Sort of the triple crown of badness.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think part of the difficulty, I think, sometimes is that you have to explain too much about the sport to have the book make sense.
Yes, especially
and people who are not interested in the sport per se are not interested in the explanation.
Yes, because for an American audience, well, you know, once again, you talked about the age. An American audience under 40 would completely understand the world of, as we call it, soccer, or you call it football.
Yeah.
Me, not so much.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, for example, that there's a big, huge difference in understanding in this country, football teams are arranged in divisions, and at the end of the season, the team at the bottom of the division goes down to the division below, and the team at the top of the division below them moves up. Now, you don't have that in the United States. I mean, no matter how badly a baseball team performs, nobody's going to throw them out of Major League Baseball into AAA baseball.
No, they'll just throw the players. They'll just send the players down.
So you don't have... There's a real... At the end of the season here, there's a real pressure and a real excitement about relegation and promotion that you guys just don't have at all, as far as I know, in any of your sports. So, right away you have something that's a completely different animal.
Well, I think maybe it's the American idea of individualism and blame the individual. It's your fault.
Yeah, well, here we have this, I guess, the view that, you know, the team did badly, you're down. Yeah. But even at this stage, halfway through the season, even at this point, we're all already going like, oh, God, if we lose this game, that relegation creeps that wee bit closer. You know.
It's all part of the excitement. What's up next? What are you, considering the amount of work you've released in the past 18 months, I'm sure you've got something on tap for 2015.
Well, next year's book will be a Tony and Carol novel.
Do you have a title yet, or are you keeping that close?
At this point, I have the working title is Splinter of the Silence.
And are you going to be programming any festivals?
I'm still on the Harrogate committee. And I'm doing a BBC radio drama serial. And I'm also doing something I've never done before at some point next year. I'm adapting someone else's work for radio, the science fiction writer John Wyndham.
Oh,
I'm
he's
adapting
great.
His no- yeah, he's terrific. I'm adapting The Kraken Wakes for radio.
Ooh.
So that'll be an interesting experience.
It's so hard to get BBC radio here. You really have to do a deep dive to get them. As far as I know, they don't release on podcast, and boy, I wish they did.
Yeah, I think stuff, there's some stuff on podcasts, but mostly you have to do it via the iPlayer Listen Again, which is live for a month after a broadcast. Well, I think they should launch it as a subscription service. I'm sure people would be very happy to pay a modest subscription, you know, $20 a year or something for BBC Radio.
Absolutely. Yeah. Val, it's really been wonderful. Thank you so much for your time and for...
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Nancy. It's been
great. Telling us all about what you've done and what's upcoming. And I look forward, as I'm sure everybody will, to the BBC Radio play. That's really interesting. In addition to the Tony Hill, Carol Jordan book.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe a sequel to my children's book.
Ooh, that would be great. Thank you again.
No, it's a pleasure.
Speaking of Mysteries is going to take a break for the holidays. We'll return on January 5th with an interview with Thomas Perry about his new Jane Whitefield mystery, A String of Beads. During our interview, Tom told me that his wife, Jo Perry, is publishing her first mystery, Dead is Better, in early January as well. Speaking of Mysteries plans to talk to Jo about it. Until then, I hope everyone has a wonderful holiday season, Merry Christmas, and Happy New Year to everyone. This is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.